and romantics, welcome to the special Valentine's edition of the Book Report. As Goethe said, this is the true season of love, when we believe we alone can love, that no one could have ever loved so before us, and that no one will in the same way after us. Sigh. Yes, today's show previews new titles dedicated to this timely topic. But fear not, our selects will be memorable, not mushy. For love is a many-splendored and a many-sided thing. We spotlight some lighthearted love stories, an intriguing nonfiction title, and some tales of love with a darker side. My guest today, Charlie Lovett, introduces you to First Impressions. We discuss why Jane Austen, who features in the story, remains one of the genre's most beloved writers. So let's turn now to page one of the Book Report. Just hitting the shelves, The Rosie Effect, the highly anticipated sequel to Graham Simsion's The Rosie Project. Dawn Tillman and Rosie Jarman are back. The Wife Project is complete, and Dawn and Rosie are happily married and living in New York. And, quite unexpectedly, expecting their first child. Dawn sets about learning the protocols of becoming a dad, but his unusual research style gets him into trouble with the law. Fortunately, his best friend Jean is on hand to offer advice. He's left Claudia and moved in with Dawn and Rosie. As Dawn tries to schedule time for pregnancy research, get Jean and Claudia to reconcile, help Dave the baseball fan save his business, and stay on the right side of Lydia the social worker, he almost misses the biggest problem of all. He might lose Rosie when she needs him the most. The San Francisco Chronicle said, "Sometimes you just need a smart love story that will make anyone, man or woman, laugh out loud." Dan O'Grady performs the book.
Although my anger was not directed towards him, he did not appear to discern this subtlety. He pushed his hand against my chest, probably in an attempt to preemptive self-defense. I reacted automatically, grabbing his arm and spinning him around. He crashed against the elevator wall, then came at me again, this time throwing a punch. I was now responding according to my martial arts training rather than my emotions. I avoided his punch and opened him up so he was undefended. It was obvious he understood his situation and was expecting me to strike him. There was no reason to do so, and I released him. He ran up the stairs, leaving his washing basket behind. I needed to escape the confined space and followed him. We both ran out onto the street. I initially had no direction in mind and locked into following Jerome, who kept looking back. Eventually, he ducked down a side street and my thoughts began to clear. I turned north towards Queens. I had not travelled to Dave and Sonia's apartment on foot before. Fortunately, navigation was straightforward as a result of the logical street numbering system, which should be mandatory in all cities. I ran hard for approximately 25 minutes, and by the time I arrived at the building and pushed the buzzer, I was hot and panting. My anger had evaporated during the altercation with Jerome. I was relieved that it had not driven me to punch him. My emotions had felt out of control, but my martial arts discipline had trumped them. This was reassuring, but now I was filled with a general feeling of hopelessness. How would I explain my behavior to Rosie? I had never mentioned the meltdown problem for two reasons. One, after such a long time and with my increased base level of happiness, I believed that it might not recur. Two, Rosie might have rejected me. Rejection was now a rational choice for Rosie. She had reason to consider me violent and dangerous. And she was pregnant to a violent and dangerous man. This would be terrible for her. Hello? It was Sonia on the intercom. It's Dawn. Dawn, are you okay? Sonia was apparently able to detect from my voice and possibly the omission of my customary greetings salutation that there was a problem. No, there's been a disaster. Multiple disasters. Sonia buzzed me up. Dave and Sonia's apartment was larger than ours, but already cluttered with baby paraphernalia. It struck me that the term ours might no longer be applicable. I was conscious of extreme agitation. Dave went to fetch beer, and Sonia insisted that I sit down, even though I was more comfortable walking around. What happened? Said Sonia. It was an obvious thing to ask, but I was unable to formulate an answer. Is Rosie all right? Afterwards, I reflected on the brilliance of the question. It was not only the most logical place to begin, but it helped me gain some perspective. Rosie was all right, physically at least. I was feeling calmer. Rationality was returning to deal with the mess that emotions had created. There is no problem with Rosie. The problem is with me. What happened? Sonia asked again. I had a meltdown. I failed to control my emotions.
You lost it?
Lost what?
You don't say that in Australia. Did you lose your temper?
Correct. I have some sort of psychiatric problem. I've never told Rosie.
We've just heard The Rosie Effect by Graham Simsion. Charlie Lovett, son of an English professor, was born in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. After attending Davidson College, he went into the antiquarian book business. Though he left the book business in the early 90s, he continued to be an avid book collector. He now has a large and growing collection of rare books and artifacts connected to Lewis Carroll and his world. In fact, his most recent acquisition is Carroll's own 1888 typewriter. Charlie has written numerous articles and books about Carroll and has lectured on the Alice in Wonderland author across the U.S. and Europe, including at the Smithsonian, Harvard, and Oxford. Charlie received his MFA in writing from Vermont College. He and his family then went to live in England and immersed themselves in the culture for 6 glorious months. After returning to the U.S., Charlie became a successful playwright. His big breakthrough as a novel writer came when he combined 2 of his passions, rare books and the English countryside. The Bookman's Tale was a resounding success. Today we'll speak to Charlie about his new title, First Impressions. Welcome, Charlie, and thanks for joining us on the Book Report.
Thank you for having me.
Early on in First Impressions, a guy in a bar laments, "What really gets me is these Austin fangirls running around pretending the sun rises and sets with some chick who wrote soap operas 200 years ago." So, Charlie, how is it that Jane Austen is still so amazingly popular?
You know, I reread several of her novels to prepare for writing my novel. And I think one of the reasons is she writes about the same issues that people struggle with today, with issues of interpersonal relationships and making choices and young people making their way in the world. And I found it all quite relevant, actually, to my own fictional heroine, to study the paths of her fictional heroines and see how they handled those sorts of issues.
Right. You wrote the book with 2 storylines. What were the challenges in creating the book in this way?
Well, you wanted to be sure to intercut at the right places. And in this particular case, I wrote this book. I would write 40 or 50 pages of the 1796 storyline that involves Jane Austen as a main character. And then I'd write 40 or 50 pages of the present-day storyline, the mystery about the rare book that involves Sophie Collingwood. And then I would sort of figure out how to intercut those pieces so that we could follow these parallel stories and there would be connections between them that became clear based on how one story ends a chapter, and then the next story begins a chapter.
Right. Introduce us to Mr. Mansfield.
Richard Mansfield is a fictional character. Some people have asked me to clear that up, whether he's real or not real. And he is a friend that I gave to Jane Austen. He is 4 times her age. He's 80 years old when she's only 20. But he's a retired clergyman who has dabbled in writing a little bit himself and becomes a mentor for Jane and someone who encourages her on her path as a writer. He sees in her the genius that we all can see retrospectively, but he's seeing it in a 20-year-old young woman who's just starting out in her life as a writer.
And introduce us to Sophie, Winston, and Eric.
Sure. Sophie is she's about 25 years old. She's just graduated from Oxford. She's in the present-day storyline, and she, like some of Jane Austen's characters, is trying to sort of figure out what the next step in her life is and where to go. But she's fascinated by books, and old books in particular. So she takes a job at an antiquarian bookstore. And one of the people that she meets through this job is Winston, who's a sort of dashing-looking publisher who's looking for this rather obscure book, which it turns out another customer is also looking for. And previous to taking the job, she's also met this American person who you just quoted earlier in the interview, Eric, who seems to be, you know, sort of a slacker, and she's not quite sure what to make of him. And as the story progresses, I I hope the reader will start to sense that perhaps one of these characters might turn out to be a Darcy character and one of them might turn out to be a Wickham character. But Sophie's really not quite sure which one is which, and who she should trust and where her loyalty should lie.
Right. You know, I was fascinated to learn that some collectors go after multiple editions of the same book just to sort of delight in the differences of the printing. Tell us more.
Well, it's absolutely true. My father, for instance, was what we call a single-title collector. He collected Robinson Crusoe, and it's a book that's been in print constantly since it was first published in 1719. So he has really, over his 700 copies, a history of publishing, of printing over those almost 300 years. And in the same way, I wanted to sort of explore this idea that on rare occasions, we as collectors, we think the first edition is the most valuable one. But every once in a while, there's an edition that's not the first edition that's the most valuable one. And so I wanted to come up with a rare book where the second edition would be priceless and the first edition would be worthless. And asking myself why that might be gave me what I think is a very interesting book for Sophie to be on the trail of, and the book that sort of thrusts her into this Jane Austen mystery.
We're speaking with Charlie Lovett on The Book Report. Right. How did you become a collector of all things Lewis Carroll?
Well, when I was a child, I used to listen to these long-playing records of an English actor named Cyril Richard, who most people probably know as Captain Hook in Peter Pan, reading Alice in Wonderland. And I listened to those records for years before I ever actually read the book on paper. And so as a young man, intrigued by my father's hobby and interested in following in his footsteps, I thought, well, I've enjoyed Alice in Wonderland, and that is a book that's been illustrated by many different illustrators and published in many different languages. And so I went down that rabbit hole, and now I have a house full of things that are related to Alice and to her creator.
You know, one of the characters describes his view of heaven as reading great books in beautiful places. Quote, Proust in Paris, Dante in Florence, and Jane Austen in the English countryside. Have you done this?
Well, I haven't read Proust in Paris or Dante in Florence, but I've certainly read Jane Austen in the English countryside. My wife and I have a cottage in Oxfordshire that we spend a few weeks a year relaxing in, and a small community that we're a part of. And I was actually over there when I was first working on the ideas for First Impressions. I traveled down to Steventon, where Jane spent the first 25 years of her life. But I also spent some lovely days just sitting in the cottage, rereading Jane Austen's novels. And it is a marvelous place to do it, because so much of what she writes about is seeped in the English countryside, and you know, people taking walks and people going on visits to these lovely houses, and to be surrounded by all that while you're reading in that world was a lovely thing.
I visited Jane's home in Chawton and saw her writing desk. It was so easy to picture her looking out onto the main street, pen in hand. Have you traveled to all of her home sites?
I have, and the thing that I find so remarkable about that very little table that you mentioned is to think about, I think about my writing desk, which is, you know, a fairly large desk with piles of papers all over it, and a computer, which is very handy if you happen to be, you know, editing and moving things around. And she had this tiny little almost circular table and a quill pen and some paper, and she produced some of the greatest novels ever. It's a very humbling thing to stand and look at that table and imagine that not only did she write these wonderful novels, but she wrote them with what to us seem like, you know, very simple tools.
Which is your favorite Austen work?
I think probably Sense and Sensibility. I mean, Pride and Prejudice is such an easy one to go to, and it is marvelous. But there's a lot of things I like about Sense and Sensibility. I like, because Jane herself, for the last years of her life, lived with her widowed mother and her unmarried sister, this idea of the women sort of living in the household together without a man that you get in parts of Sense and Sensibility, I think, to me, really feels connected to her experience. And I just love the story. You know.
For those who don't know, why is it that Jane never married?
Well, you know, I'm not really a Jane Austen expert. It's very interesting. I'm starting to get questions about Jane's life. And when I was writing her, I was careful not to read too much of her biography. I really wanted her character in my novel to emerge out of her novels rather than out of her biography, although I wanted to get the facts of her life straight. But we do know, or we believe, that she had a flirtation. We're not quite sure how serious it was at one point as a young woman. And she did have one proposal, which she rejected. But for the most part, she lived her life with her family and without romantic attachment.
What one piece of advice would you give to someone who wants to start collecting a 20th century author, for example? Who would you collect and why?
Gosh, it's a hard question, but I think the main thing is to collect someone that you love. Collect what you love to read. I don't see any point in having books on my shelves if I don't want to take them down and look at them and read them and share them with other people. So I would absolutely go where your passions are. And then beyond that, simply, you know, look for copies that are in great condition. Especially with 20th and 21st century books, that's something that collectors are always looking for, is good condition and that the dust jackets are still there and those kinds of things.
What's next for you?
Well, next year I have a Christmas book coming out. I'm very excited about that because I've never done a holiday book before. And it is a sequel to Charles Dickens' famous book, A Christmas Carol, but I've written it sort of in the voice of Charles Dickens. I sort of compare myself to a stand-up comic doing impressions. I wanted to think, what would it have been like if Dickens had come back to that character and that book 20 years later and written about what Ebenezer Scrooge was up to at the time? So it was great fun to work on. We're in the midst of looking for an illustrator right now, so it'll be a slim little volume that'll be available for the Christmas season. And then I'm also working on a new novel that is set in an English cathedral library, and so it will be all about medieval manuscripts and all the various intrigues that happen in a setting like that over 1,000 years or so.
Hmm. Any final thoughts about first impressions?
Well, I hope people enjoy the book. One of the questions I've gotten is what do people want to take away from it? And I certainly want people to just have a fun read. And a couple of different people have used the word romp to describe this work, which makes me very happy because I want people to enjoy reading a nice story. But I hope also it might encourage people to either go back and reread Jane Austen or perhaps to read Jane Austen for the first time, because if I can guide some people in that direction as well, that would be something really wonderful.
Well, Charlie, your book was a great fun to read. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
And now let's listen to a sampling of First Impressions, read by Jane Entwistle.
I think Mansfield Park isn't properly appreciated by the establishment, said Sophie, doing her best impersonation of his impersonation. That was you. She only scowled in response. Well, come on, said Eric. It's such a cliché line, all that stuff about Mansfield Park not being appreciated. It may not make as good a movie as some of the others, but of course it's appreciated. Even if you were right, that's entirely beside the point. And what is the point? That you're an ass, said Sophie. Yes, but wouldn't talking to me be more interesting than walking alone? She stared at him, detecting an intensity in his eyes that belied his relaxed attitude. Finally, she sighed and said, marginally. Great, said Eric, starting toward Oxford. She wasn't sure how it happened, but by the time they reached the edge of Port Meadow, they were deep in conversation about the youthful style of Northanger Abbey. Listen, tomorrow's Saturday. I thought I might drive down to Steventon, said Eric at a lull in the conversation. You want to come? Sophie had, in fact, never been to Steventon, the village in Hampshire where Jane Austen had spent the first 25 years of her life and had written the first drafts of three of her novels. She would have loved to go, but not with him. And in any case, she couldn't help laughing at his transparency. Does that work? She asked. Does what work? That ploy. You find out a girl's favourite author and then offer to drive her to Jane Austen's birthplace, or George Orwell's gravesite, or Charles Dickens's favourite pub. I don't like Dickens. How can you not like Dickens? All that poverty. It depresses me. At least Austen's heroines end up in nice big houses. Setting aside the fact that I find you disagreeable, said Sophie, the truth is, I have plans tomorrow. Oh, I don't think you find me disagreeable, said Eric. Then how do you think I find you? I think you're intrigued by me. And even though I'm rude and generally unpolished, you think you might have finally met someone who appreciates Jane Austen as much as you do. When I heard you the other night, my first impression was that you were a prat, said Sophie, annoyed that he had so accurately guessed what she was thinking. She had dated Clifton for 2 years, and he never knew what she was thinking. This guy had known her for 20 minutes, and he could read her like a book. It was unnerving.
First impressions can be misleading, said Eric. Just ask Eliza Bennett.
Come to Steventon with me.
I have plans.
What plans?
I have to go home for the weekend. My mother's having a thing.
A thing?
A garden thing, said Sophie. It's a sculpture show. My mother is a bit obsessive about her garden. She thinks it's the finest in Oxfordshire.
What sort of things does she grow?
Latin things, she said. English names aren't good enough for my mother. Everything is Latin. She hadn't meant to sound quite so harsh. Sophie actually liked her mother's use of Latin. It reminded her of her Uncle Bertram reading Horace to help her fall asleep when she was a girl.
I take it you're not a gardener, said Eric.
I like to read in the garden, said Sophie, and I can tell a flower from a shrubbery and a shrubbery from a tree, but my thumb has always been distinctly black.
And your father?
What about my father?
What sort of chap is he? Asked Eric.
Oh, really, don't use the word chap. You're American. Don't try to pretend otherwise.
Sorry, what sort of bloke is he?
Sophie rolled her eyes. He likes to shoot things. They're quite the pair, my parents. Mother only wants to grow things, and father only wants to kill them.
We've just heard First Impressions by Charlie Lovett. From Anita Diamond, author of The Red Tent and Day After Night, a coming-of-age novel about family ties, love, friendship, and feminism. Addie Baum is the Boston girl, born in 1900 to immigrant parents, suspicious of America and its effect on their three daughters. Growing up in the North End, then a teeming multicultural neighborhood, Addie's curiosity takes her to a world her parents can't imagine, a world of short skirts, movies, celebrity culture, and new opportunities for women. Addie wants to finish high school and dreams of going to college. She wants a career, and she wants to find true love. Diamond unrolls the story with 85-year-old Addie sharing the story of her life to her 22-year-old granddaughter, who asks, "How did you get to be the woman you are today?" Actress Linda Lavin's performance brings a moving portrait of one woman's complicated life in 20th century America.
The best part of that week was my time with Philomena. We stayed up late every night talking. She seemed so grown up, I couldn't believe that she was only 19, just 3 years older than me. We started with our families, and I still remember all of her sisters' names. Maria Immaculata, Maria Teresa, Maria Domenica, Maria Sophia, and she was Maria Philomena, the youngest and also the only unmarried one. Her parents died when she was a baby, so Mimi, Immaculata, raised her. The whole family lived within a few blocks of each other in the North End, and when I met Philomena, she was staying with Sophie, Maria Sophia, and sharing the couch with two of her three boys. Philomena said she looked forward to coming to Rockport Lodge just so she could sleep without a squirming child waking her up. Philomena left school when she was 12 and went to work sewing in a factory. A few years later, she started going to the Salem Street Settlement House on Saturdays. I told Mimi that I wanted to improve my English, she said, but really it was just to have a little time when I wasn't at work or taking care of someone's baby. Miss Chevalier noticed her sketching in the library when she was supposed to be studying, but instead of yelling at me, she took me to meet Miss Green. And here I am. Not so different from my story, right? Miss Green sent her to the museum school for a drawing class. I owe her everything, Philomena said. She taught me pottery and design and gives me art books to look at. She says that being an artist is more than a job or a skill. It's a way of walking through the world. I didn't understand what that meant until a few days later when we went to the Headlands, which Miss Holbrook said was the most beautiful view on Cape Ann. Irene rolled her eyes. Stone soup, anyone? But Miss Holbrook was right about the headlands. It's a special place, up high, maybe 100 feet above the sea, with water on three sides. You know where I'm talking about, right, Ava? It's the place I always bring people who've never been up to Cape Ann. You can see for miles up and down the coast. It's got a nice view of the boats in Rockport Harbor, and most of the town, too. The first time I saw all those white clapboard houses and the church steeple, I thought about how much I owed to Paul Revere for getting me there. Miss Holbrook called it picturesque, and I knew exactly what she meant without having to look it up. It was like one of those tinted picture postcards. A perfect blue sky and fluffy white clouds, sailboats, and even a few ladies with parasols. The lodge girls scattered around to pick flowers or sit on the rocks and talk. Rose and Irene climbed halfway down the bluff, which almost gave Miss Holbrook a heart attack. Philomena went off by herself to draw, but I tiptoed over to peek at her sketch pad. She was drawing the pile of rocks in front of her, which seemed like a dull subject, but when I looked again, I saw she had made the same shapes into a woman's body, lying on her side, completely naked. I'd probably never seen a nude picture before. I must have gasped. Philomena turned around and held it up so I had a better view. What do you think? Before I could answer, Miss Holbrook came running toward us, yoo-hooing for Philomena to come with her. Two ladies had set up easels to do watercolors of the harbor. You should meet them. They are painting the most charming little harbor scenes. Philomena wrinkled her nose. Miss Green says charming is a trap that women artists should avoid at all costs. Miss Holbrook said, These ladies are very accomplished, I assure you. Philomena stared her in the eye and said, Miss Edith Green is an instructor at the School of the Museum of Fine Arts. And she is the one who told me to focus all my attention on drawing this week. I'm sure you agree I should take her assignment seriously. Miss Holbrook couldn't say no to that. Walked away with her tail between her legs.
We've just heard The Boston Girl by Anita Diamond. Miranda July's debut, The First Bad Man, Cheryl is a tightly wound, vulnerable woman who lives alone with a perpetual lump in her throat. She's haunted by a baby boy she met when she was six, who sometimes recurs as other people's babies. Cheryl is also obsessed with Philip, a philandering board member at the women's self-defense nonprofit where she works. She believes they've been making love for many lifetimes, though they have yet to consummate in this one. When Cheryl's bosses asks if their 21-year-old daughter Clee can move into her house for a little while, Cheryl's eccentrically ordered world explodes. And yet it is Clee, the selfish, cruel blonde bombshell, who bullies Cheryl into reality and unexpectedly provides her the love of a lifetime. Tender, gripping, hilarious, infused with raging sexual obsession, Miranda July, who narrates, shows herself to be an original and important new voice.
He drew a circle on the paper's throat and filled it in with careful cross-hatching. How long have you had the globus? On and off for about 30 years, 30 or 40 years. Have you ever had treatment for it? I tried to get a referral for surgery. Surgery. To have the ball cut out. You know it's not a real ball. That's what they say. The usual treatment is psychotherapy. I know. I didn't explain that I was single. Therapy is for couples. So is Christmas. So is camping. So is beach camping. Dr. Broyard rattled open a drawer full of tiny glass bottles and picked one labeled red. I squinted at the perfectly clear liquid. It reminded me a lot of water. It's the essence of red, he said brusquely. He could sense my skepticism. Red is an energy which only develops a hue in crude form. Take 30 milliliters now and then 30 milliliters each morning before first urination. I swallowed a dropper full. Why before first urination? Before you get up and move around, movement raises your basal body temperature. I considered this. What if a person were to wake up and immediately have sex before urination? Surely that would raise your basal body temperature too. If I had been in my early 30s instead of early 40s, would he have said before first urination or sexual intercourse? That's the problem with men my age. I'm somehow older than them. Philip is in his 60s, so he probably thinks of me as a younger woman, a girl almost. Not that he thinks of me yet. I'm just someone who works at Open Palm. But that could change in an instant. Could have happened today in the waiting room. It might still happen if I called him. Dr. Briard handed me a form. Give this to Ruthie at the front desk. I scheduled a follow-up visit, but if your globus worsens before then, you might want to consider some kind of counseling. Do I get one of those crystals? I pointed to the cluster of them hanging in the window. A sun drop? Next time. The receptionist Xeroxed my insurance card while explaining that chromotherapy isn't covered by insurance. The next available appointment is June 19th. Do you prefer morning or afternoon? Her waist-length gray hair was off-putting. Mine is gray too, but I keep it neat. I don't know. Morning? It was only February. By June, Philip and I might be a couple. We might come to Dr. Briard's together, hand in hand. Is there anything sooner? The doctor's in this office only 3 times a year. I glanced around the waiting area. Who will water this plant? I leaned over and pushed my finger into the fern soil. It was wet. Another doctor works here. She tapped the Lucite display holding 2 stacks of cards. Dr. Briard's and those of a Dr. Tibbetts, LCSW. I tried to take one of each without using my dirty finger. How's 9:45? She asked, holding out a box of Kleenex. I raced through the parking garage, carrying my phone in both hands. Once the doors were locked and the AC was on, I dialed the first 9 digits of Philip's number, then paused. I had never called him before. For the last 6 years, it was always him calling me, and only at Open Palm, and only in his capacity as a board member. Maybe this wasn't a good idea. Suzanne would say it was. She made the first move with Carl. Suzanne and Carl were my bosses. If you feel a connection, don't be shy about it, she'd once said. What's an example of not being shy about it? Show him some heat. I waited 4 days to spread out the questions, and then I asked her for an example of showing heat. She looked at me for a long time and then pulled an old envelope out of the trash and drew a pear on it. This is how your body is shaped. See? Teeny tiny on top and not so tiny on the bottom. Then she explained the illusion created by wearing dark colors on the bottom and bright colors on top. When I see other women with this color combination, I check to see if they're a pair too, and they always are. 2 pairs can't fool each other.
We've just heard The First Bad Man by Miranda July. In Budapest Romance by Rosa Gaston, Katie Dunai travels to Budapest to settle her father's estate. The last thing on her mind is the pursuit of pleasure. She's devoted to her job. Her life is rooted in Manhattan. But from the moment she sets foot in the city, it's pleasure that pursues her. At the spa hotel where she's staying, she meets Jan, a Dutchman there to mend from a motorcycle accident. Jan's scars have healed on the outside, but inside, he cannot forgive himself for the consequences of the accident. Jan has never met a woman like Katie before. Her blend of New England restraint with gypsy spirit captivates him. While Jan introduces Katie to Budapest's leisurely pace of life, Katie introduces Jan to her own leisurely pace of sensual exploration. When Katie returns to New York, their relationship continues. But it's not just an ocean that separates them. Which will Katie put first, her career or her new love? Romy Nordlinger performs the book.
How could she not notice being noticed? Loading in a thermal bath pool at a spa hotel in Budapest, Kati discreetly eyed the rugged blonde man lounging in the next pool. He had glanced in her direction several times over the past 2 days. She was mourning the death of her father the month before and was in no shape to be looking at the opposite sex. But the man's shaggy blonde hair had caught her eye that first evening in the pools. It had wandered down over his shoulders and powerful chest as well. Bela Dunay would have forgiven her, she knew. At that moment, the man lifted his head and looked directly at her. Immediately, she pretended to be studying the clock on the wall behind him. She hoped he was too far away to notice the blush that had sprung onto her face. She wanted to pass for a sophisticated European woman while in Hungary, but here she was, blushing like a schoolgirl at a strange man, having forgotten completely about her father's passing for a brief moment. The next evening at the baths, Kati made a point of keeping a cool expression on her face as she surveyed the room. The blonde man was there again. Careful not to glance in his direction, she obliquely noted he was near a group of men playing chess in the water. He sat at the side of the pool, idly swinging his legs while watching their game. Her eyes flicked over his legs. Oak tree trunks came to mind. Pretending not to have seen him, she stared dreamily in the other direction. Did she sense the blonde man's eyes upon her? Arching her neck, she jutted her chin out, hoping it made her look more like her favorite movie actress, Audrey Hepburn. She wanted to know if he was watching her. Again, pretending to look at the clock on the wall behind him, she arched her eyebrows as if realizing she had an important appointment. She didn't. The man looked directly at her. Kati completely lost her nerve. Summoning the remains of her composure, she rose slowly from the pool and disappeared into the women's locker room. How could she maintain a dignified mourning posture when she was being distracted by a blonde bear of a man? Upstairs in her room, she felt restless. Her body warmed by the thermal baths, she went out on the balcony where the cold night air pinched her. Something else did too. Her father's spirit nudged her at the railing.
Who are you kidding, little daughter? You may be mourning my loss, but there's someone with eyes on you now who wants to get to know you. Let him.
Dad, I'm here to wrap up your affairs, not meet a man. It's completely inappropriate.
Let life happen to you, Katika. Don't run from it.
We've just heard Budapest Romance by Rosa Gaston. How far would you go for the perfect love? In this erotic psychological thriller, You, by Carolyn Kepnes, a young man's dark obsession with an enigmatic writer leads to murderous consequences. When aspiring writer and recent Brown graduate Guinevere Beck strides into the bookstore where Joe works, he's instantly smitten. Beck is everything Joe ever wanted: gorgeous, tough, razor smart, and sexy. Beck can't resist her feelings for a guy who seems custom-made for her. So when her boyfriend Benji mysteriously disappears, Beck and Joe fall into a tumultuous affair. But there's more to Beck than her oh-so-perfect facade. Their mutual obsession quickly spirals into a whirlwind of deadly consequences. Santino Fontana performs this chilling account of unrelenting passion.
You grab a book and sit down in the aisle, and maybe you'll stay here all night. Maybe it'll be like the Natalie Portman movie Where the Heart Is, adapted faithlessly from the Billy Letts book, above par for that kind of crud, and I'll find you in the middle of the night. Only you won't be pregnant, and I won't be the meek man in the movie. I'll lean over and say, "Excuse me, miss, but we're closed." And you'll look up and smile. "Well, I'm not closed." A breath. "I'm wide open, buddy." "Hey," Salinger Brown bites. "He's still here? He's still here. Can I get a receipt?" "Sorry about that." He grabs it out of my hand. He doesn't hate me. He hates himself. If people could handle their self-loathing, customer service would be smoother. You know what, kid? You need to get over yourself. You work in a bookstore. You don't make the books. You don't write the books. And if you were any good at reading the books, you probably wouldn't work in a bookstore. So wipe that judgmental look off your face and tell me to have a nice day. This man could say anything in the world to me, and he'd still be the one shame-buying Dan Brown. You appear now with your intimate Portman smile, having heard the... I look at you. You look at him, and he's still looking at me, waiting. Have a nice day, sir. I say, and he knows I don't mean it. Hates that he craves platitudes from a stranger. When he's gone, I call out again because you're listening. You enjoy that damn brown! You walk over laughing, and thank God it's morning. And we're dead in the morning, and nobody is gonna get in our way. You put your basket of books down on the counter, and you sass. You gonna judge me too? What an a**hole, right? Probably just in a mood. You're a sweetheart. You see the best in people. You compliment me. Well, I say, and I should shut up, and I want to shut up, but you make me want to talk. That guy is the reason the Blockbuster shouldn't have gone under. You look at me. You're curious, and I want to know about you, but I can't ask, so I just keep talking. Everybody's always striving to be better. Lose 5 pounds, read 5 books, go to a museum, buy a classical record and listen to it and like it. What they really want to do is eat donuts, read magazines, buy pop albums, and books? Books. Get a Kindle. You know why Kindles are so successful? You laugh and you shake your head and you're listening to me at the point when most people drift, go into their phone, and you're pretty, and you ask, why? I'll tell you why. The internet put porn in your home. I just said porn. What a dummy. But you're still listening. What a doll. And you didn't have to go out and get it. You didn't have to make eye contact with the guy at the store who now knows you like watching girls get spanked. Eye contact is what keeps us civilized. Your eyes are almonds, and I go on. Revealed. You don't wear a wedding ring, and I go on. Human. You are patient, and I need to shut up, but I can't. And the Kindle takes all the integrity out of reading, which is exactly what the internet did to porn. The checks and balances are gone. You can read your Dan Brown in public and in private all at once. It's the end of civilization. But there's always a but, you say, and I bet you come from a big family of healthy, loving people who hug a lot and sing songs around a campfire. But with no places to buy movies or albums, it's come down to books. There are no more video stores, so there are no more nerds who work in video stores and quote Tarantino and fight about Dario Argento and hate on people who rent Meg Ryan movies. That act, the interaction between seller and buyer, is the most important two-way street we got. And you can't just eradicate two-way streets like that and not expect a fallout, you know? I don't know if you know, but you don't tell me to stop talking the way people sometimes do. And you nod. See, the record store was the great equalizer. It gave the nerds power. You're really buying Taylor Swift? Stop saying Taylor Swift. Are you laughing at me or with me? Anyway, I say, and I'll stop if you tell me to. Anyway, you say, and you want me to finish. The point is, buying stuff is one of the only honest things we do. That guy didn't come in here for Dan Brown or Salinger. That guy came in here to confess. Are you a priest? No, I'm a church. Amen.
That Was You by Carolyn Kepnes. Swoon, Great Seducers and Why Women Love Them by Betsy Prelo is a glittering pageant of charismatic ladies' men from Casanova to Lord Byron to Ashton Kutcher. It challenges every preconceived idea about great lovers and answers one of history's most vexing questions. What do women want? Contrary to popular myth, the men who consistently beguile women belie the familiar stereotypes. In this surprising, insightful study, we find that legendary ladies' men are often without looks or money. They fit no known template and possess a cache of powerful erotic secrets. Using evidence from science, popular culture, fiction, anthropology, and history, Prelu finds that great seducers share a constellation of unusual traits. They radiate joie de vivre, intensity, and sex appeal, and above all, they adore women. They listen, praise, amuse, and delight, and they know their way around the bedroom. They've finessed the hardest part, locking in and revving desire. Finally, Prelu takes stock of the contemporary culture and asks, where are the Casanovas of today? Holly Fielding narrates.
Pembroke, a hamlet once known as Scuffletown, population 2,800, sits on the southeastern flatlands of North Carolina on Highway 711, home to the University of the North Carolina Braves, the Lumbee Indians, the Berea Baptist Church, Dollar Tree, Papa Bill's Ribs, a nearby drag strip with a wheel-standing contest, and one of today's hottest ladies' men. Jack Harris is a psychology professor at the university in his 40s, with a buzz cut, tidewater slur, and a vocation you don't see much anymore. Women charming. As early as I can remember, he says over a beer, there have always been women. In the attic, on trailways, on Amtrak. And come on to me. What is it? Let me think. Well, I kind of intuit what they need. I love them. I want to please them. There are names for a man like Jack. Roué, rake, lady killer, Casanova, Don Juan, seducer, Mac, babe magnet. In French, he's called a tombeur. In Japanese, ikimen. In Russian, Krasovchik. In Chinese, color wolf. In Spanish, muerigo. In Portuguese, mulherengo. In German, a Frauenjäger. But he's still a mystery man in any language, enveloped in a pall of myths, prejudices, and armchair theories. Who is this ladies' man, this sexy devil? There's really no good name for him. A man who lights up women, adores them, and love-addles them for life, defies all the familiar models. Smooth players, money lords, or any of the scientific therapeutic versions of the alpha romancer. He baffles every ingrained image. He's the lover nobody knows. Jack, for instance, fits no paradigm. I've always found myself extremely average, he tells me. And it's true. He has a long El Greco face and dresses in boondocks casual, short-sleeved shirt, no-brand jeans, rigger boots, and a gold crucifix around his neck. He's without rank, riches, power, resources, or the appeals of security and stability. He left a tenured job in South Texas on a whim and admits he's pretty volatile. As for seduction techniques, I don't try to do it. I think it's instinctive. I'm just very comfortable around women. And he drains his beer and crushes the can for emphasis. I cannot make love to someone unless I have emotional feelings for them. I'm not the type to make a conquest and move on. I mean, the women who have broken my heart. This is the Mr. Irresistible of such renown, the man women chase down, covet, and can't forget for decades later. Nothing computes. By all rights, Jack shouldn't be in the running, much less reeling in women right and left and fending off co-eds with mash notes in their trembling hands. For centuries, ladies' men like Jack have been locked in a stereotype, distorted and stigmatized beyond recognition. But feelings about them are deeply divided. They're both denounced and admired, censored and secretly cherished. They're walking projections of the forbidden, an amalgam of envy, suppressed wishes, and stifled passions. They've also been silenced. If we let them have their say, though, we'll see a different man altogether. A complex, out-of-box charmer who smashes the seducer templates and redefines male allure. Despite the concept of an individual love map, a unique Jack for every Jill, a few men have garnered the majority of women throughout history. In a 2004 cross-cultural DNA study, Dr. Michael Hammer and his colleagues at the University of Arizona found that certain males passed on the bulk of genes to the next generation. Women, he concluded, seem to have similar tastes. Some men are consistently chosen over others. They're sexier, more fascinating, more something.
That was Swoon by Elizabeth Prelow. Love reasons without reason. Indeed, Mr. Shakespeare. Readers, I hope you've enjoyed these tales of love's many sides. But of course, in a topic this broad and this close to all our hearts, there's more to explore. So check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining me today. I hope your celebration is filled with cards, roses, chocolates, and wonderful moments with the one you love. This weekend, have a happy Valentine's Day. And next week, let's meet again for the next edition of The Book Report.